a star named Wormwood, an angel named Abaddon, who's also called Apollyon. Who is this? Tonight we are in Revelation chapter 8, beginning there in verse 10, down through verse 12 of chapter 9. It is quite a lengthy text, but there's a lot there, and it flows quite quickly. And the main reason that it flows quite quickly is because these things have yet to happen. And so I'm not able to point you back to events that happened and say, see, this was what we're talking about. Because what we're talking about here tonight is the things that are going to take place in the future. As you remember already in the book of Revelation, we've seen Jesus take the scroll of the future, as it were. And on that scroll, there are those seven seals. And Jesus begins to open that scroll. And each one of those seals that is broken unfolds another chapter of history, another chapter of suffering, as it were. There are many hundreds and millions of people who die from famines and wars and plagues and certain things like this. And there are many martyrs, people who die for the name of Christ. And they are there under the altar there in heaven, and they're crying out to the Lord, how long until you avenge our blood? And then we see that there are signs in that sixth seal that's broken open. There are signs there in the heavens where the moon is turned dark, or it's turned red, the sun is turned black, the stars are shaken and thrown to the earth. You see that there are cosmic effects that are going on here in the future. And this is how we know these things have not yet taken place. Because when you read them in Scripture, they are so grand, they are so marvelous, they are so universe-shattering that when they happen, you will know it. You will know it without any question, without any doubt. You will know that it has taken place. So I would even say that anybody that you see on TV for the Prophecy Hour or anything like that, people who get on TV and they talk about these things, when they say this has already taken place, you probably should question that. Because these events that are talking about, they shake the cosmos. They shake all of the earth, they shake the planets, and they shake the stars. As it says there earlier in Revelation, that the stars are shooken, they're shaken rather, they're shaken so violently and they're thrown to the earth as when a fig tree is blown by the wind and the figs fall to the ground. So those signs happen there in the heavens. And then you see as a direct result of these great signs in the heavens, just as it says in Joel chapter 2, that they will see these things and they will call upon the name of the Lord. And he says, and so it will happen in those days that all who call on the name of the Lord will be saved. And you see there in chapter 6, those 144,000 of Israel who are born again. And you see, rather, chapter 7. And then you see right after that this grand picture that John has in the throne room, in God's throne room, where we have people of every tribe and language and tongue and nation all worshiping before God. And then what you see in the breaking of that seventh seal, that final seal on the scroll of the future, of the end of all things, when that seventh seal is broken over, you see that there are more happenings to take place. In fact, there are seven trumpets to be blown. Seven trumpets to be blown, and then part of that seventh trumpet, it branches off again, and there are seven bowls to be poured out. There are bowls of judgment, and we'll get to all that in due time. But at this point, we have covered a couple of these trumpet blasts that have taken place, and it's been a couple of weeks since we've been here, so we're going to look at those just real quick, and we're going to move on into this text. But what I want you to see tonight, the flavor that I want you to get from this text, is what I think the main idea of this text is this, that because God makes distinction in his judgment between his own people and between the people who are not his, it's incumbent upon all people to put their faith and their trust in Jesus. You'll see that from the way that these events unfold and the way that the judgments of God unfold. They unfold in such a way, you'll even see it as this horde from hell pours out and these demons are tormenting people, that they're not killing them, they're not putting them to death. Why is that? Well, it's God's act of mercy. They're not put to death. They're put in torment, and they're given a bit of a preview. If you don't turn to God, if you don't trust in God, this is what's going to take place forever. This is the kind of fellowship you can expect to have in heaven. Now, it says in verse 7 of chapter 8, It says that this first angel blows his trumpet, and there's hail and there's fire mixed with blood that's cast to the earth. And it says a third of the earth is burned up, a third of the trees, and all of the green grass. And I've given you a bit of a framework to look at the book of Revelation, at the judgments of God in Revelation. If you will get a good grasp on what took place there in Egypt when God delivered his people Israel out of Egypt, you can have a pretty good understanding of what's going on here in the end of all things. Because just as God made a distinction between the Egyptians and his own people, he makes the same distinction here in the end between those who are not his people and those who have called on the name of the Lord. And he embarks on these plagues, and he unleashes these plagues, these great and disastrous plagues that make the plagues of Egypt pale in comparison. And this first plague that takes place, this first trumpet that's blown that announces the judgment of God, the warring of God on the earth, it says that a third of the grasses, all the green grass is burnt up, a third of the earth is burned up, a third of the trees are burned up. It matches up very well there with the seventh plague that took place in Egypt as God made hail to rain down, hail and brimstone to rain down there on the land of Egypt as an act of judgment. The second trumpet that's blown there in verse 8, it says that there was something like a great mountain burning with fire thrown into the sea. So he's talking about salt water here. The salt water is affected. A third of the sea became as blood. Matches up really well with that first plague that took place there in Egypt as God turned the river Nile and all the fresh water and all that into blood there in Egypt. And many of the fish and animals died. And the people had to dig around that fresh water so that the water could be filtered through the ground and they could drink some muddy water because that's as good as they were going to get. It says a third of the living creatures there in verse 9 died. And a third of the ships were destroyed. And I pointed you to Isaiah chapter 2, verse 11 through 16, which is a picture of the day of the Lord. And in that passage, Isaiah actually talks about when this happens, the reason that God destroys the ships that are on the seas. It's figurative, but it's also literal. It's figurative in the sense that the ships are the things that people trust in those days for their commerce and for their trade. They look at their ships and they think, what mighty works we've done. We've conquered the ocean. And yet with one drop in the bucket, with one stone that God throws from heaven, this great mountain burning like fire, he sends into chaos everything that man seems to trust in, so that you have to ask yourself, in the end, in those days, who's your trust in? Is it in God, or is it in the things that you have built with your hands, the things that you've stored up? What does Jesus tell us there in the Gospels? He says, store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys. We're not talking about moths and rust at this point. We're talking about great burning mountains cast into the sea. This is unmistakable. We're talking about a meteor the size of a continent that falls into the sea such that a third of the sea turns into blood, whether that is the blood of humans that is so overflowing into the water that it actually dilutes the water. Think of all this rain. Many of you in here, you're fishermen. You're very well aware of Sabine Lake back here. Think of all that rain that came down from East Texas. All that fresh water. What has it done to Sabine Lake, which is a saltwater lake? What has it done to it? It's diluted it. It's a freshwater pond now, isn't it? Such might be the same case when God casts this great mountain there in the ocean, and yet it doesn't turn into fresh water, it turns into blood, because that overwhelming flow is so great. Now in verse 10, where we pick up for tonight, says, the third angel blew his trumpet, and a great star, that word there is aster, it's where we get our word asteroid from. A great star fell from heaven. Now this is a literal star that falls from heaven, unlike a star that we'll read later on that's representative of an angel. The third angel blew his trumpet, and a great star, an aster, fell from heaven, blazing like a torch. And it fell on a third of the rivers and on the springs of water. You notice the difference here? There in the second trumpet, God touched what kind of water? The salt water. But here in the third trumpet, God touches the fresh water. He's going to affect not the commerce that people have. He's going to affect the water that we need to consume to live. He's going to touch that water so that everyone on earth feels the effect of this great star that falls down from heaven. So it fell on a third of the rivers and on the springs of water. The name of the star is Wormwood. Now, the third of the stars became wormwood, and many people died from the water because it had been made bitter. This text that we're looking at tonight is probably one of the most infamous texts in all of the book of Revelation, because you have two names that are used. In fact, three names that are used, that when we read those names, we go, what on earth is he talking about? A star named Wormwood, an angel named Abaddon, who's also called Apollyon. Who is this? We don't know who these are. But it's really not as complicated as it looks. When you read that word wormwood there in the Greek, it's actually a word that every one of us has heard. The word is absinthon. Absinthon. You've heard that word before. It means absinthe. Absinthe. It's a plant. It's a pretty common plant, and it's common because it's poisonous. If you know much about plants, some of you do, you know that absinthe is poisonous. Many people throughout the centuries have used absinthe to make alcohol. They've used it to make alcohol, and it has a character. I don't know this from experience, by the way, but it has a characteristic bitterness to it, such that some people will take a cube of sugar and they'll lay it over on a stick or on a spoon over the top of a cup, and they will take that absinthe alcohol and they will pour it over that sugar, and they'll dissolve the sugar in there to kind of ease the bitterness, or they'll even light the sugar on fire. It's really freaky looking. It's really strange looking. I that's the only reason I know this is because I studied it for this sermon, okay? That's it. Sure. Okay. This is not me. This is not me. So, this star that falls from heaven is a star named Wormwood, or the star named Absinthe. And you may wonder, why is it named Absinthe? Why is it named Wormwood? It's named Wormwood because of its effect. Because of its effect as it falls on this water. One of the characteristics of absinthe, when it's not taken care of properly, you can actually extract a chemical from it named thujone. Thujone. And that thujone chemical is known to cause epilepsy, or cause epileptic seizures. It has many neurological effects, such that some people used to, in prohibition, they outlawed the making of absinthe, and they said it had hallucinogenic effects. It's going to affect your nervous system. Well, that's not entirely false. In fact, it's mostly true. That is the effect of wormwood when it's used as poison. And so God sends this star. He casts the star down from heaven, the star named Wormwood, and as it hits a third of the rivers, as it hits a third of the fresh springs of the earth, it turns it into a poisonous, noxious drink, such that you can't drink it, or else you're going to die. One of the things that you see, especially here in these first four trumpets that are blown, you almost see an unmaking of creation. You see an unraveling of creation, as it were. You see the trees burned up, the grass burned up, and you look back at the beginning chapters of Genesis, and you see that God made all these things. He calls it good. He speaks them into existence, and he steps back, and he admires his own work, just as only God can do. But now, in these final chapters of the same book, you see God unraveling that very creation that he had made, such that he affects the trees and the grass, all the plants, all the salt water, all of the fresh water as well. Verse 12 says, "The fourth angel blew his trumpet, and a third of the sun was struck, and a third of the moon, and a third of the stars, so that a third of their light might be darkened, and a third of the day might be kept from shining, and likewise a third of the night." That ninth plague that took place there in Egypt, you remember it quite clearly. It was the plague of darkness. Remember, it says there in Exodus chapter 10 that darkness was so thick that it was a darkness that could be felt. It was a darkness that could almost be touched. said that people stayed in their homes for 3 days and they did not get out of their bed because they could not see to walk, they could not see to move. God has done these things before, but he is going to cause in these days the sun, the moon, and the stars to hold off a third of their light. For a third of the day, they will not shine their light. And in fact, he talks about this in Isaiah chapter 13, verse 9 through 12. Behold, the day of the Lord comes, cruel, with wrath and fierce anger, to make the land a desolation and to destroy its sinners from it. For the stars from the heavens and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be dark at its rising, and the moon will not shed its light. So one thing that we can expect to see if these things happen in our time, in our generations, is for a third of the day to be dark and a third of the stars to not shine their light and a third of the moon to not shine its light. You imagine how much work that cuts back on? How much that we can't be productive because we don't have any light to do. Imagine Egypt almost every single day with the darkness there. Now, as I said, those first four trumpets that you read of, it seems that the earth and the stars, the heavens, are unraveling on itself. And you see almost like it's earth making war against itself, the universe coming unraveling. It's like Paul talks about there in Romans chapter 8 about how the whole earth groans with labor pains until the day of redemption. And now you're seeing the baby. You're seeing those labor pains get to their absolute worst before the coming of the Lord. But the fifth trumpet is different. The fifth trumpet is not the earth and the universe coming unraveled. The fifth trumpet, what you see, is you see hell unleashed. You see hell unleashed on earth. You could literally say the fifth trumpet is hell on earth. Look here at it. Which will begin in chapter 9, but as you see there in verse 13, there's something that takes place before that fifth trumpet happens. He says, "Then I looked, and I heard an eagle crying." Some Greek texts say that that eagle was an angel. It's inconclusive, though. "And I heard an eagle crying with a loud voice so that everyone can hear as it flew directly overhead. Whoa, whoa, whoa," intensifying the claim of calamity, disaster. That's what that word means. "Woe to those who dwell on the earth." Now, this is a distinction between those who have the mark of the Lord, the mark of God on their foreheads. You'll see there in Revelation 9, verse 4. He says, "Woe to those who dwell on the earth at the blasts of the other trumpets that the three angels are about to blow." What does this sound like? This sounds like a warning, doesn't it? Woe, watch out. Disaster's coming. Calamity is coming. Why do you warn people? Let me ask you that. Why do you warn people? You warn people in order to save them, in order to protect them. Now, if you read through these trumpet judgments and the unfolding, the unleashing of God's wrath against sinners, as it talked about there in Isaiah 13, if you read through that quickly, you say, man, this is so dark. Man, this is so heavy. Wrath, judgment, death. But here's God in the middle of this judgment, in the middle of this doom and gloom, proclaiming the gospel, proclaiming to watch out, beware of the things that are coming. And in fact, this fifth trumpet that's blown, you will see that the judgment that unfolds, it's so terrible, but it's not unto death. Miraculously, in fact. Miraculously, God allows people to be tormented and to go through judgment without dying. Now imagine the purpose for that. Why would God allow people to feel his judgment, see his judgment, endure those dark times, but at the same time preserve their life? Mercy. This is grace. This is giving everyone on the earth a preview of the judgment of God that will be unbridled in the lake of fire for eternity, and yet he preserves their life so that they have time to repent. I see the gospel all through the book of Revelation. I see the mercy of God all through the book of Revelation. So this angel, this eagle, cries out a warning to all those who dwell on the earth. And it says there in chapter 9, beginning in verse 1, "And the fifth angel blew his trumpet, and I saw a star." This is a figurative star here. You'll see why I say that. "And I saw a star fallen from heaven," and he's already fallen, "to the earth, and he," it's not an it, this is a he, this is a personal being, not a person, but a personal being, "and he was given the key," signifies authority, power, dominion. "He was given the key to the shaft of the bottomless pit." That word there for a bottomless pit is the word, the Greek word, abusun, abusun. Sounds very familiar to us. It's where we get our word abyss. A deep, dark hole, darkness so dark that you can feel it, a depth that is unfathomable, is the literal rendering of that word. So he's given the key to the bottomless pit. "He opened the shaft of the bottomless pit, and from the shaft rose smoke like the smoke of a great furnace. And the sun and the air were darkened with the smoke from the shaft." I was thinking about how to characterize this so that you can get a good visual, a good mental visual picture of how this looked. And I had to do a little bit of research and look past my time a little bit and ask some people who are a little more seasoned than me. Does anybody remember what happened on May 18th, 1980? I wasn't born yet, but that's it. Mount St. Helens erupted at 8:32 a.m. There were a bunch of people out on the side of the mountain who were planting trees and taking care of this pristine park, and there were people filming the great boring mountain. All of a sudden, the mountain wasn't so boring anymore. 8:32 a.m., May 18th, 1980, that mountain erupted. It blew in half. Their estimates are that as that mountain blew up in an instant, a cubic mile of ash and molten rock went into the air, covered the entire eastern part of the state of Washington. It was said that the smoke and the ash were so thick for so long that a surgical mask, you know what we wear when the pollen gets real bad sometimes or you're sickly? They said that a surgical mask quadrupled in price because that ash and soot was so thick and so dense in all of the state. In fact, they said on that day that it was pitch black. It was pitch black in the eastern part of Washington at noon, because of that smoke, because of that great plume that came up at the eruption of that volcano. Now, imagine that times I don't know how many, such that there's darkness over all of the face of the earth. And you'll know why there's darkness, because there's smoke coming out, not from a volcano, which has a limit. No, this smoke is coming out of the bottomless pit, a place designed for destruction, a place designed as a place of torment and imprisonment for demons. It is opened and it is unleashed. This angel is given a key to go and open that. He is given a key because God allows him to do this. God is the one setting these things in motion. So he opens the key to the bottomless pit, the shaft of the bottomless pit. And from the shaft rose smoke like the smoke of a great furnace, like a massive volcano. And the sun and the air were darkened, and the smoke from the smoke of the shaft. Verse 3. "Then from the smoke came locusts on the earth." Sounds like the eighth plague there in Egypt. "There was locusts on the earth, and they were given power like the power of scorpions on the earth." Still sounds like an insect flying around. We actually have hordes of locusts that will flood the earth from time to time. There was one that happened in Russia just a few years ago, a couple of years ago, in fact, destroyed massive amounts of crops there. But these are not any ordinary locusts. In fact, they're not insects at all. These are demons. This is a horde from hell. "Then from the smoke came locusts on the earth, And they were given power like the power of scorpions on earth. We'll get to what that means. They were told not to harm the grass of the earth or any green plant or any tree. They have a specific mission. But only those people who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. What you see here is the same thing that God did as God killed all of the livestock with the hail there in the eighth plague there in Egypt, and he made a distinction between Israel and he made a distinction between the Egyptians. You see here now these elect, these people who have the mark of God on their foreheads, they are spared of this judgment. These demons who are let loose from this bottomless pit have a very specific mission, and it is to torment those who dwell on the earth, but they are not allowed to touch the elect. They're not allowed to touch those who have been sealed with the seal of God. You may say, well, that certainly sounds strange. It actually doesn't. In biblical understanding, that doesn't sound strange at all. You remember back in the beginning chapter, the first chapter of the book of Job. Satan approaches God, and God asks Satan about Job, have you considered my servant? He says, there's none like him on the earth, and God gives Satan the ability, the power, the authority to touch Job's family and all of his possessions. But he says, you can go no further. And what does Satan do? He goes no further. He does exactly what he is told, and these hordes out of hell, these demons, these locusts, they go no further. They touch only those who do not believe in God. Only those who do not believe in Jesus, to be more specific. Verse 5 says, they were allowed to torment them for 5 months. So this torment would be terrible, but it'd also be temporary. They were allowed to torment them for 5 months. But, and that's the strongest adversative particle there in the Greek, the word Allah. But not to kill them. They're allowed to undergo the torment from God's judgment, but they're not allowed to die. So they're going to have time to respond here. And their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it stings someone. It's interesting here. In that area where John was testifying, where he's prophesying from the island of Patmos, as he looks over, he can see Turkey. And obviously, he came from Israel, and he's come from all these Middle Eastern states, and he's walked through those areas. There is a very familiar scorpion there that almost everyone in the region would have known. One of them is known as the Israeli desert scorpion, or the yellow Palestinian scorpion. It's also known by this name, the Death Stalker. Death Stalker. It's a yellow. It almost looks plastic. It almost looks like a toy. But it's a massive scorpion, about the size of my hand. It's a massive scorpion. And I'm going to read to you something that I got off of one of these scorpion lovers. I don't know that there's such people, but apparently there are. But there's a scorpion website where you can do all sorts of research. And this is what this person said about this Death Stalker scorpion. He said, the sting is something that humans are never going to forget if they are lucky to get out alive. The sting is something that humans are never going to forget if they are lucky to get out alive. You step on this scorpion, you're stung by this scorpion. If you're of old age or you're a young child, if you are not fit as it gets, you probably will not survive the sting of this scorpion. And if you did survive it, you would never forget that type of intensity, that type of pain for the rest of your life. Such is the case with the torment that these demons are allowed to undertake to the people who don't believe in Jesus. They're allowed to inflict that same kind of torment, the kind of torment that if a person lives to see the end, they'll never forget it. I think God's trying to get a point across here, isn't he? To those who dwell on the earth, those who don't have their faith in Christ. He's getting the point across that these angels, these demons that come out of the bottomless pit, who in Revelation chapter 20 will be bound again forever in the bottomless pit and cast into the lake of fire. He is letting all people who don't believe in God understand that those angels that are tormenting you, understand that that's going to be your company of fellowship in hell. He's giving them a preview of hell by bringing hell to earth. I talked to a young man yesterday in the mall, a very sad conversation as I was sharing the gospel with him. And as we spoke and talking about Jesus and talking about eternal things, he began to scoff, began to mock, just like it says there in Psalm 1. Began to scoff at the things of God and the things of eternity. And I said, what are you going to do? What are you going to do when you die? If I'm right, and you're either going to spend eternity in heaven or eternity in hell, what are you going to do about that? And he said, if I had my choice, I would choose to live in hell because I'll go to hell and I'll do all the things that I want to do here and I'll go and chum it up with Satan. I said, you've got to be out of your mind. Do you not believe what the word says? Do you not believe that hell is not ruled by Satan? Hell is a place of torment. Hell is a place of imprisonment. Satan has no throne in hell. Satan is released from imprisonment. These demons that have been confined there in eternal chains, they are released from imprisonment. Satan does not rule hell. God rules hell. And the people who survive this torment in the fourth trumpet, the ones who endure, which will be all of them, they will wish they had never seen it. It says that they're going to wish that they could die. In fact, that's what the text continues to say. And in these days, verse 6, people will seek death and will not find it. They will long to die, but death will flee from them. They're going to experience the torments of hell and wish that they could just go out of existence, but God won't allow them. Such is the case, such is the reality of hell itself for all those people who do not have their faith in Jesus. When you die, where would you rather spend eternity? In a place of grace and mercy, experiencing all the goodness of God forever, or a place designed as a place of imprisonment and torment for these angels who have fallen out of their place of glory? As that young man said that, I thought, wow, man. You just don't have an understanding of what the Bible says hell is really like. They will long to die, but death will flee from them. What an act of mercy that God gives people there in the end. He gives people a preview of what eternity in hell really looks like and really feels like, but he won't let them die. Because what does the Bible say? It's appointed for man once to die, and after that, the judgment. God is still giving these people time to repent, and there are some people whose hearts will be softened through hard times. Hasn't that been the case with many of us? Had a hard heart until something really bad happened, and God used that difficult time, that hard time, to soften your heart. Well, now in the end, he's going to turn the heat up as hot as it possibly gets. Look at verse 7 down through 11. In appearance, the locusts were like horses prepared for battle, and on their heads were what looked like crowns of gold. These are glorious, majestic beings. Their faces were like human faces. These are personal beings. These are no insects. These are demons from the bottomless pit. Their hair, like women's hair, makes me think that they must have some sort of beauty to them. The Bible tells us that Satan himself disguises himself as an angel of light. And their teeth, like lion's teeth. You know, locusts don't have any teeth. They get onto a plant and they just kind of gnaw it away. But these locusts, these demons are very different. They have the purpose of devouring, very much so like Peter says there in 1 Peter 5:8, your adversary, the devil, roams to and fro, roaring like a lion, seeking whom he may devour. That's these demons' purpose. Their teeth like lion's teeth. Verse 9, they had breastplates like breastplates of iron. They are impenetrable. They are undefeatable. Bullets are not going to stop these demons. And the noise of their wings was like the noise of many chariots with horses rushing into battle. In some way, these creatures, these demons, are winged. I had the imagination of this, that it would be like an army, a vast array, an innumerable multitude of helicopters armed for war. And you hear the rushing of those chopper blades. It says that's what this horde sounds like. They have tails and stings like scorpions, and their power to hurt people for 5 months is in their tails. They have as king over them the angel of the bottomless pit. His name in Hebrew is Abaddon. If you look in Job chapter 28, verse 22, you actually see that Hebrew word Abaddon, but it's not the name of a person, it's the name of a place. It's the name of Sheol, or the name of destruction. When you read the Old Testament and you read about that place called Sheol, or the place called Abaddon, that's what you're reading about. You're reading about the place of destruction for the ungodly. But it says that there is one given authority to rule over this horde, a king to rule over this horde, and he takes the name of the place from where he comes. He takes the name Abaddon. And in Greek, he is called Apollyon. That word just literally means destruction. Isn't that an appropriate name? Sure is an appropriate name for this demon ruling over this horde. But look at verse 12. The first. That word implies more, doesn't it? First implies a second. In fact, there are three woes. There are two more woes to come after this. The first woe has passed. Behold, two woes are still to come. When I read this, especially chapter 9, verse 4, and I read that God makes a distinction. God makes a distinction between those who are his, those who have the seal of God on their foreheads, marked for his possession, marked for his protection. And I read that God makes a distinction between them, and he doesn't allow them to go under the same torment. What I see is that God is giving everyone on earth a preview of eternity. He's allowing people to see this is the reality. God really does divide the sheep and the goats. God really does depart the righteous from the wicked. And the wicked will not inherit the kingdom of God. My prayer for us tonight as we read this, I understand that this is in the future, but I also understand that this is a present reality. That even now, God makes a distinction between those who trust in his son Jesus and those who do not trust in his son Jesus. And it's incumbent upon every one of us to make certain that our trust is in the Lord, so that, as it says in Hebrews, it's appointed for man once to die, and after that, the judgment. When the day of the Lord comes, when you die, or when Jesus sends these judgments to come, where will your trust be found? The second thought I had on this, what a powerful message for us to move into sharing our faith with people. Think about that young man I encountered there in the mall. Think of if the truth had not been shared with him, he would have gone on thinking for the rest of his life that he could go to hell and go about his merry own way and everything would work out in the end. He may very well go to hell. He may very well never trust in Jesus, but he cannot say he has not been warned. Let's tell people about reality. You pray with me.